first of the blows is going to be next Tuesday at 2. So there will be two more lectures on the Thursdays of this term, but there's also the first, which is Tuesday at 2, which you're welcome. And that will be held not in here, but in the chapel, which is upstairs as you come in at the main entrance. So if you're coming next week for this, then Tuesday at 2 will be in the chapel, and then the subsequent two Thursdays will be back in here. Because it's been a joint venture all the way through, we've tried to cooperate in different ways, and we're glad that this evening the director of the Oxford Centre for Hindu Studies, Sean Hirishi Das, who's well known to many of you, is going to introduce our guest speaker for this evening. So over to you, Sean.
Thank you very much, Nick. It gives me great pleasure to introduce Dr. Savita Vich. Savita gained her PhD from the University of Birmingham in the Everyday Politicization of Hindus, subtitle, Being Hindu in a University Context. And that's a very interesting thesis for someone in England to do, especially a member of the community. And she went further and co-pioneered a project called the Hindu Youth Report, which was a survey of 400 young Hindus, a 16-page questionnaire, quite a commitment. And we launched it in the House of Lords to all the leaders of the Hindu community in this country. So quite a contribution to the community and a good piece of scholarship there as well. And now she's applying to the Oxford Centre for a postdoctoral fellowship and wants to write up her thesis, so we hope she does, and then we'll all get to see it eventually. So Hindus and Hinduism, thank you, really.
Thank you. Okay, I should explain a little bit more about the background of my thesis as it informs this paper and the Hindu Youth Report. Am I audible to everyone?
Not very.
No? Okay, I need to speak louder. My thesis was based upon research at Birmingham University with the Hindu Student Society. And I began this because the first year I was there, the society dramatically changed and became a lot more politically active. And during the course of my study, I found that this politics was related to a wider trend in Britain amongst second-generation Hindus to redefine their identities as Hindu. And it also fed into another wider international trend, and that is a politicization of Hinduism through Hindu nationalist movements, which I don't know how many of you are familiar with. The origins lie in India. They're called the Sangh Parivar. And they define Hindu-ness in a very authoritarian manner. And they are having I personally believe, quite a negative effect on Hindu identity in this country. So I will touch upon some of these issues. My research was based on a number of different layers. It involved students, young Hindu students that joined society for purely cultural reasons, and also some students that I would describe as pro-Hindu activists. And they have been responsible for creating a political body in this UK, one of them being the National Hindu Students Forum, which began in 1991 and has created an infrastructure of local Hindu societies within the universities in the UK. And they are affiliated to this wider Hindu nationalist body, the Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh in India. And the second project that I've looked at, as Shona Gudi described, is a Hindu youth survey, which was co-pioneered with another young lady. And we felt there was a gap in the market, in the academic market, and community research as well upon second-generation Hindus. And we basically conducted surveys with 400 young Hindus on their attitudes towards religious beliefs, gender, political issues, and how they feel they are positioned within this country. That's a general background of where I will be speaking from. So I think I begin with the fact that it's actually a very exciting time to be young and Hindu in this country, as there is a process of reinterpretation that is taking place of what it means to be Hindu and how we understand Hinduism. My insight is not theological, but sociological. That's the perspective that I take. And I analyse how a process of rebranding is taking place. The main trends that I examine are outlined. How we can understand the context of modern Britain and the nature of contemporary Hindus and Hinduism, the unique socioeconomic position of Hindus in this country, and the narrative of success, the performance of faith and identity to both represent community and create unity, the reinterpretation of traditions and practices in a way that is seen to be more rational, and lastly, the politicization of Hindus and Hinduism. Contemporary cultural consumerism. Siddharth Bucher and Christine London Smith have brought to the stage Strictly Dandiya, a play which touches upon many issues that are relevant to the contemporary environment in which Hindus are redefining their identities. This text is used as an introduction into my debates. It is based around the experiences of first and second generation Gujaratis from various Jati backgrounds, the Patel, Shahs and Luanas. As the majority of Hindus in this country are statistically Gujarati, Vertevec estimates around 70%, and they are very well placed socioeconomically. It is their stories that are gaining prominence in the diaspora. Thus, this play helps us set the context of British Gujaratis, and Yasmin Alibi Brown introduces them. They are brilliant small businessmen. They are brilliant small businessmen. They love discretion, dislike too much clamour for rights, accept the establishment and class order. It links nicely with caste hierarchies, prefer infiltration to revolution, excel at compromises, like to believe that they are very tolerant and self-effacing. This conjures up stereotypes of a homogenous community preoccupied with class positioning. However, as Strictly Dandiya and my other research goes on to show, the drive to rebrand contemporary Hindus and Hinduism is driven by the juxtaposition of lived, fluid, contradictory community and faith reproductions and the desire for a more coherent, rational framework of representation. And this in itself reveals much about the changing politics of representation in this country and more internationally that links to the politicization of Hindus and Hinduism since the 19th century. Jacobs writes about the historically based studies which point to the 19th and 20th century periods to locate stirrings and collective mobilization. And here we begin to see the formulation of connections between Hindu, Hinduism and a Hindu community. Prior to the 19th century, faith, cultural practices and social organization were disorganized without a text, central figure of authority to organize around. And Jacobs points to the effects of the British presence in India and how the concepts of Hinduism, deduced from Hindu, became the faith of Hindus, more through the eyes of Christian missionaries, Western Orientalists, and the British religious classifications, which postulated them as a religious community. Hindus thus began to locate their own practices and identities within the reality of globalization and nationalism, and Hindu became a significant focal point of collective identity, despite its obvious diversity. In the migration of Hindus to Britain, there have been two major studies conducted by Burgat and Vertevec. Burgat, firstly, as Hindus began to settle in this country. And he shows how transitions to Britain and the reorganization of Hindus and Hinduisms can be described initially as a trans-ethnic Hinduism. And he analyses the development of faith practices in Britain, e.g. distinct caste formation, changing relationship between sectors and castes, and the growth of human spokespersons that were undeniably shaped in a British context. Vertevec's work, The Hindu Diaspora, updates this assessment within global times and multicultural settings, and observes that in Britain, whilst regional, caste, doctrinal, devotional, and regional differences continue to be reproduced in local milieu, singular concepts of Hinduism and Hindu identity have been forged, defined, refined, and rallied around. His conclusions suggest that despite the differences in interpretations and ways of substantiating being Hindu in the diaspora, Hindus themselves attribute authoritative status to India. This paper continues to existing discussions, but in a more recent context. The 2001 census estimates the number of Hindus as 552,000, which constitutes a significant minority. Whereas information about Islam and Muslims or Sikhs is more readily available in media and academic circles, there's very little information or very much heard about the experiences of Hindus in this country. Although, like Burgat and Vertovec, I celebrate the progress of Hindus in the diaspora, I'm slightly more cautious. I find that spaces for reinvention and consumption of contemporary Hinduisms can feed into right-wing international authoritarian projects by voices that shout the loudest in the new markets of representation. The first section I look at, A Taste to Our Success. Gotta have ambition. When Idi Amin chucked me out, I came with just my muffler and anorak, and look where I am now. That's one of the characters' statements in the play. And there are many characters in the play that are built around socioeconomic success. All of the first generation Hindu parents have made successful businesses and equally well-established community organization. Brahma Dutani in the play, the head of the Luana Ladies Committee, for example, and it appears the children have been university educated, producing the likes of IT expert Dinesh Shah, who on his first appearance announces, "I've just installed the new application on your dad's Excel program. It means that he can pinpoint exactly what stock he's got, in what outlet, serial number, model quality." The fact that Hindus are very well placed socioeconomically in this country should not really come as much of a surprise. It's one of the very few things that is constantly picked up by the media. The Asian Wealth Index, which is produced by the Ethnic Media Group, gives an indication of the percentage of Hindus that have crossed the threshold of £5 million. 42% of them are Hindus, in relation to 26% who are Muslims and 24% who are Sikhs. The profiles of entrepreneurs such as Mike Titania, Mr. Ghulam Noon, Natiram Puri, Madhubai Madhvani, Biko and Vijay Parikh, and the list goes on, highlights the rapid success that many of these first-generation migrants have made in Britain. And even more astonishing is the meager beginnings and struggles that have been faced, in particular by East African Asians. Journalist Paul Harris documented the story of Jaffa Kapasi, who arrived in Britain as an 18-year-old, with the other 27,000 Ugandan Asians who arrived in 1972 as nothing. After his university years, he set up his own financial consultancy business. Since this, Harris writes, he served as head of the powerful and Ugandan Asian-dominated Leicester Asian Business Association. And it is the transferable skills, education and community networks that have allowed Kapasi and many of the other migrants to quickly build up on their empires. The second generation are also well positioned and beginning to recognize their middle-class status. In my doctoral research, a fair indicator of class background was given by parents, professions, nature of schooling, and financial support in university education. Parents' professions included doctors, teachers, university lecturers, engineers, and successful self-employed business persons. From the 35 students I interviewed, over half had received private or grammar schooling, and they often emphasise the importance that had been placed upon their education. Student finance was provided by parents who were willing to invest in the comforts of ensuite accommodation and as a compensation for their parents' working class lives. And parents were rewarded with the status that education brings. Class position was also taken into consideration into how it is used by second generation Hindus in self-description. as professional middle class, to stress their otherness as Hindu from Asian. This is an issue that Dulika Raj, in her study of student activism amongst Hindu, also points out. She cites a student lecturer who asserts why Hindu should be stressed over Asian. It was not my community that supported Saddam Hussein, and it wasn't Hindu youth that hacked to death that white boy in East London. If anything, if they can be called problems at all, they are clearly Muslim problems. If there is a Hindu problem, then we should ask the media to define it as a Hindu problem, but not as a blanketing effect, as an Asian problem. The National Hindu Students Forum, a student body set up in 1991, promotes a similar viewpoint in their Vision in Action. We must help the media and other influential organisations to gain a positive perception of the Hindu as distinct from the broad label of Asians, whose definitions include a massive range of ethnic minority groups. Hindus have done and are continuing to do a great deal of good for this country in areas of business, education and the medical professions. Isn't it time that Hindus obtain recognition for these achievements rather than all the Asians taking the credit? This emphasises an explicit concern over definitions and the power of identifications, whereby a parity with the middle class is made clear, and otherness is racialised using faith categories. Social class becomes hidden behind the cloak of religion as a way of life, which success is attributed to. In other words, we have done well, and you have not, because of religion. From these examples, it appears that novel articulations of religion and caste have become the modalities in which class relations are lived. As Bhatt analyses, the religious boundaries between Hinduism and Islam in the UK can often function as metonymic class boundaries between economically successful fractions of East African Asian merchant communities and relatively impoverished Pakistani and Bangladeshi communities. At moments, it was ironic in the Hindu Youth Report, where young people expressed that they were lacking in formal religious instruction precisely because their parents had been so involved in developing themselves socially, economically. One student commented, "I think in this country our parents had a lot of pressure in terms of culture. They came from abroad and wanted to see us do well. Religion does play a part, but it's the cultural aspects that we have turned into religion. We want to find out more about that, but before we do, we have to get a good education, a good job." There is a continuity across generations for the perceived need to establish themselves professionally as a foundation before pursuing religious affairs. Wealth is now, however, becoming demonstrated through charity donations to the buildings of temples and towards religious and cultural events. Jitu Patel, Naresh and Mahesh Patel, ex-co-owners of the private convenience store Europa, plan to invest the bulk of their 53 million windfall from the sale of the company into Neasden Temple, a part of the Swaminarayan Sampradaya. Caste interests, in this case the ascendancy of Bhattidars, in terms of wealth, have become realigned in the framework of a new global economy that rebrands a particular into having a more universal value. Socioeconomic success is thus to be celebrated with the position that is afforded by this, to have a greater purchasing power in the market of representation. My caution would be firstly recognizing the responsibility that various castes and sectarian groups have in ensuring the access to representation of the community, faith and identity. Secondly, and linked to this, is the need to ensure that Hindus that don't fit into this narrative, for example, Hindu Mauritians, Hindu Bengalis, and especially the large number of Nepali Hindu refugees that have been creating very different forms of community, are often absent from this research upon contemporary Hindus and Hinduisms. And this is an area I hope to be building upon in the future. The next section, Asian Skin Hindu Masks. On behalf of my committee, I'm proud to announce an inter-caste dance competition, Patels, Luanas, and Charles, altogether competing for the much coveted titles of Diwali King and Queen. The two lucky winners will be crowned at the grand finale on Saturday. They will have the honour of taking their place on the number one float at the Diwali parade and switching on the seasonal lights on Ealing Road. The use of performance in signifying faith identity develops out of Butler's theory of performativity. Although she uses this to explore the norms of how sexual differences are regulated and subverted, the use of performance as stylized repetition of acts and mimicry to create faith and ethnic identities and how they produce is taken more seriously. This is an issue taken up by Chetan Bhatt, who looks at how the Aryan memory is rejuvenated by neo-Hindu authoritarian movements to reconstitute diasporic belonging. In this paper, I build upon these developments to examine how second-generation Hindus in Britain perform dance and ritual to represent and create a more marketable model of Hindus and Hinduism and Hindu identity. From Bremer's introduction to the dance competition, we can see the significance of active participation in the Navratri dance and Diwali parade. And as Alibai adds in her introduction, this is a showcase for their pride, wealth, and increasing self-belief that they are the most worthy and obliging, least troublesome immigrants to come to this country after the Second World War. And Navratri and Diwali are extremely important calendar days to do this. Although there is an immense diversity of Hindu festivals celebrated in regionally and caste-specific ways, my interest is not in comparing festivals in Britain with India, but in explaining how festivals act as markers of ethnic and faith community boundaries and identity. It is how the performance of festivals become a part of negotiating identities and transforming festivals in the process. Ethnographic research at the University Student Organization of Navratri provides some interesting insights. Navratri is celebrated around the globe in September, October, and it is indisputably one of the most popular festivals, especially for Gujarati communities. The association of Navratri with Gujaratis appears to have encouraged a different approach in organising the worship for the festival. Many Punjabis attend Navratri celebrations, but few of them consider it to be an important festival, and thus do not rank it as highly as Janmashtami or Diwali. Gujaratis, on the other hand, place a great emphasis on it. It is they who ensure that the festival is celebrated at all. And that's by nine. This may explain why Navratri festivals became more organised after the 1980s, after the arrival of East African refugees, evolving from school halls to town halls as numbers increased and organisers sought larger facilities. As Hindu communities in Britain have settled, networking across regions has resulted in annual Navratri festivals. This is a performance which is both public, spatially organised at distinct venues like town halls, but also private in its promotion as a jati, community-based activity. Many non-Gujarati students, therefore, may not have attended a Navratri festival before they attended university. The organisers of Birmingham Local Hindu Students Forum aim to encourage all Hindu students to attend at least one Navratri event together, as they were expected to provide good opportunity for inter-university interaction, excellent for improving relations with the local Hindu community, and provide good fun with religious significance. The religious significance of the event, or stories connected to why Navratri was celebrated, was not discussed at a formal or informal level, and instead the act of going to the mandir became more important. A major event organised was held at Sheffield University under the National Hindu Students Forum banner. And significant numbers attended from the local Hindu students in around Birmingham universities. Several performances were invisible and made visible throughout the night. The main decorations within the hall were the students themselves, dressed in their Janiacholi's lengas and shalwar kameezes. And dressing up gave everyone the sense of festivity, especially the girls' narratives. I remember that because I was the only girl that wasn't wearing shalwar kameez, I wasn't aware that it was going to be so big and the girls would be wearing all that which now makes me wear an Indian outfit to every function, so I definitely learnt that. As Logan adds, it is one of the times when it is de rigueur for girls to wear some form of Indian dress, usually a sari or half sari. They may wear makeup and jewellery. A number of boys also wore Shivanis along with their top and trousers. And contrary to Logan's findings, men at Navratri festivals and more generally who do not wear Indian dress. What was similar was the aspect of dressing up and how Navratri is an opportunity for teenage boys and girls to meet each other. As the music and dancing became faster, the competitiveness was enhanced, where the fittest are seen to remain as the music becomes faster and the girl dancers are judged by the male judges. Dandiya, sticks to dance with, brought the majority of students to the dance floor towards the end of the night. The performance of sexuality was subtle, yet expected, as Navratri festivals are popular with youth precisely as an avenue for flirting and dating. Other performances included labelling of the event as Hindu, where it's predominantly inspired by Gujarati traditions. The dance can therefore be intimidating to students who do not celebrate Navratri in this particular way, and a small minority of students, the Hindu Punjabis, were taught on the sidelines. Other more cultural and youth-orientated aspects includes a Hindi song sung after the Garba, followed by a dance routine by young girls. This does reflect a new hybrid celebration, mixing Asian underground music with traditional Indian diyas in respect of Diwali tradition. Taking your shoes outside the dancing area and coming together for an aarti, a religious worship, was undertaken in a similar manner to everyday pujas, with the words of the aarti sung in Hindi. Usually as Navratri is celebrated by Gujarati communities, aarti is sung usually in Gujarati. Because the aarti is not usually taken by young Hindus, there was a mixed reaction of discomfort and lack of response, although the majority participated standing around the shrine. This new presentation reveals that this moonlight event is novel in the physical participation of non-Gujarati students, infusing a youth element and more contemporary musical genres enjoyed by young South Asians. These were alongside more traditional forms of practice that are more usually practiced within local communities. For students that had no experience of attending a Navratri night, or for those who are familiar with popular traditions, this event proved to be something apart. As students mentioned, coming together from different caste and regional backgrounds and bonding. Festivals may have been part of the students' experience before university, but they may have been experienced as social events or fragmented religious community events that students have no understanding of or do not directly participate in and have no explanation for. Navratri is a popular festival demarcated by the Garba Ras amongst Gujaratis in Britain, which becomes a market model upon which the celebration of Navratri at university is predicated. Whilst the religious significance may be important for some students, for others, it is clearly a cultural space to dress up and be visible and enjoy the popular cultural music. Therefore, the performances of Navratri were consumed in a number of ways. To create new forms of collective Hindu identification amongst Hindus, to represent this as a marker of Hindu identity to non-Hindus, and fulfill various personal and social interests. Celebration of this is again hampered with caution. As some youth learn the norms of tradition through the celebrations, there is a possibility of erasing the variations and of minority traditions, minority Hindu traditions. The third section, learning the language of Hindus and Hinduisms. I just want to remind everyone of the religious significance of our festival. There is a dress code. Save the halter necks and navel jewels for the disco dandiya night. Ladies, make sure your shoulders are covered, otherwise a committee member will ask you to cover up. There is hardly any mention of religion or Hinduisms in the play. The omission of this can be questioned in light of the one reference there is cited by Brahma. There is no formal dress code for the event, yet a plea is made for reference of the religious aspects of the festival through behaviour and dress. These codes are not formalised or written, and like the core of Hinduisms, they have been passed down through oral instruction and encouraging Hindus to use their own judgments within the wider frameworks of lived faith practices. Of course, the boundaries of this materialize once they are transgressed. Learning the language of Hindus and Hinduisms highlights the reinterpretation of language, traditions, and practices by the second generation, and the ways in which they are reinventing the forms and transmissions of faith practices. Teaching and learning in the lives of the young Hindus varies considerably, as there are no formal texts or codes that prescribe a universal Hindu way of life. From my research, I found young Hindus were taught both formally and informally about their religion way of life through language, dance classes, and religious sessions in homes and in mandirs. These dealt less with conceptual and philosophical aspects than cultural practices. And those that did have a wider concept of Hinduism or being Hindu were usually affiliated to an organization, for example, the Arya Samaj or Swami Narayan Mandir, which specifically catered for youth. Whilst these movements may differ in their form, philosophies, and knowledge claims, they share a commitment to questioning the Hindu self in the modern context of colonialization and globalization. Many of these movements have been concentrated in North India, where the West has continuously made inroads through trade, conquest, and migration. By example, Arya Samaj's strength was displayed in Punjab, and the RSS has had strong footholds in Gujarat. Their reworking of Hinduism has been equally matched by Vivekananda and Gandhi, who gave Hinduism a new universal appeal, travelling around India and the West. And in Britain, we see the effect of these movements. Parikh charts Hindu migrants becoming more educated and affluent, opposing ritualistic Hinduism, which did not address problems, had little intellectual content, made absurd claims, involved time-consuming rituals, and embarrassed them in the eyes of non-Hindus. Bhakti has been as popular in the West, advocating a more personalized relationship with God, embodied by the ISKCON and Swaminarayan missions. Swamis and texts have played a more crucial role in these missions, recreating faith traditions in a Western religious context. These various perspectives and personalities that engage with discourses of the secular, religion and politics in modernist discourses have become more integral in learning about Hinduism and teaching the second generation about their national religious political identity in Britain. Hindu desires for more adequate religious nurture for their children, as well as national strategies for multi-faith religious education, may also encourage Hindus to organise themselves and to promote a more universal style of Hinduism by way of creating and distributing their own educational materials for youth throughout Britain. And students often questioned each other on how to comprehend the vast number of beliefs that Hindus held. The codification of Hindu beliefs and traditions itself has been an active and dynamic process amongst Hindus in Britain, which has taken shape among sects, sampradayas and Hindu missions, and has involved the development of ecumenical umbrella organisation that's developed by Brady in his study of Swaminarayan to show how Hindu organisations have tried to transcend caste and sectarian divisions to form more umbrella bodies. And in a group discussion, when discussing where the Hindus shared commonalities, many of the new visions that were formed in this period could seem to have influenced students' notions of Hindu beliefs. The issue of values found in Hinduism were brought up, so focusing on principles rather than practices. For example, love, tolerance, and ahimsa, non-violence. Hindu tolerance was an important strand of Sarvepalli Radhakrishnan's philosophical reflections upon the Christian critique of Hinduism. He identified tolerance as a major feature of Hinduism and noted how this was in contrast to Western religions and their intolerance of narrow monotheism, written in letters of blood across the history of many from the time when the first tribes of Israel burst into the land of Canaan. Ahimsa was popularized as an embodiment of truth force Mahatma Gandhi, the universal foundation of religion. For Gandhi, this meant the virtues of truthfulness and filial piety, which he believed should form the basis of Hinduism's. questioning social practices like untouchability and poverty. For other students, Hinduism was evoked in relation to a number of other beliefs. Religion is something you do for yourself. It's a personal thing. If you want to learn about it, you can. I believe in God, but that's as far as it goes. I have respect for all gods, and there are none that I worship the most. Once my RE teacher told me one thing about Hinduism, which is always stuck in my mind. Hinduism is like a diamond. There's so many gods, but the whole diamond is one. And that's what I believe in. There are so many, but they are one. The student's description of religion reflects personal and individual beliefs that have been relationally shaped by the conceptualizations of faith in her RE lessons. Eleanor Nesbitt, who has been researching how young Hindus' complex religio-cultural home and community background shape moral, spiritual, and cultural identity, and how this can inform material that is provided for the religious curriculum. And this can further be extended to look at the role that religious education curriculum itself has in teaching young Hindus about their beliefs and the power dynamic of young Hindus being Hindu ambassadors within these contexts and learning about the Hindu self. So, for example, young Hindus were often placed in classroom situations where they had to be the teachers of what Hinduism and Hindu beliefs, whereas they had no experience themselves. But the power dynamic is that they themselves are learning from the Western style or that religious education promotion of what Hinduism is. The diamond metaphor of choice and diversity that Zenith expresses in the form of incarnation alongside belief in the Supreme Being is an extremely popular way that Hinduism can be rationalized for young Hindus. This also takes expression in Vivekananda's philosophy, which purports a monoistic doctrine of Adi Shankaracharya's Advaita Vedanta and his message of non-duality between God and mankind, which merge together as Atma, or soul, identical with Brahma. This non-duality is taken by Vivekananda as central to a fundamental unity between all religions. This student's beliefs may not formally correspond with Vivekananda's philosophy, but more generally, the popularization of the Advaita monist beliefs allow Hinduism to be understood in the West. The rationality of beliefs was also a major concern, whereby some youth wished to relay the compatibility between modern science and Hindu beliefs. And in the Hindu Youth Report, there are many examples of how Ayurveda, yoga, and the power of precious metals were examples of the limitations of Western science and medicine. Another area where second-generation Hindus have begun to question the knowledge and faith identity is language. A diverse range of languages are spoken by Hindus: Punjabi, Gujarati, Bengali, Tamil. And despite this, the Hindu Youth report finds that Hindu youth wish for translation of religious scriptures than English and hope to have a greater access of language classes to learn Hindi and Sanskrit. Some clues may be found for this, for why they prefer to speak Hindi and Sanskrit when their community language are so diverse. And Raj suggests that an issue is not what language people speak, but which language they claim to be speaking, and the symbolic political meanings of the language. Many young Hindu Punjabis increasingly claim that Hindu is their parents' mother tongue. Like beliefs, this is a strong issue of representation and the production of new identities here in Britain. And Hindi can be a language by which the next generation can be recognized as a community. Students wish to be able to maintain languages to communicate in India, speaking to elder members of their communities and teach their children. At the same time, the next generation are ill-equipped with resources to learn their mother tongues and communicate more. The Hindu Youth Report supports many of these findings that youth would like to see in terms of beliefs. A greater stress upon the rationality of Hindu beliefs, especially scientific ones. In terms of practices, where there are stories and myths behind rituals and practice, they wish to be familiar with them. For example, stories of why we celebrate Holi or Diwali. In terms of values, they exonerate values demonstrated by Hindus in neo-contemporary Hindu movements. For example, Gandhi, Vivekananda, and Dayanand Saraswati, who formed the Arya Samaj movement. In terms of language, they wish to have the facility to learn Hindi and Sanskrit, and they wish to create a framework in which charts these disparate beliefs, values and practices. Therefore, learning about Hinduism's questioning beliefs and practices that have been taken for granted is undoubtedly a quest that has preoccupied post-colonial movements and is now also a burning question in multicultural Britain. Related to this, and equally as important, is redeveloping forms of transmission. Festivals are being seen as an important medium for a number of reasons. They are seen, this is what Nesbitt cites, as a giant laboratory of tradition where people can see, hear, touch, experiment with, and directly experience tradition. Youth that attended the Hindu Youth Festival held in Halden expressed positive sentiments about having a forum to share their ideas more virtually. And one respondent made clear the importance of having fun while learning. If you like music, sports, and other things, Hinduism can exist in these things. Temples can be a place to go for culture and values and not just for prayer. And this has influenced the formation of a body, Hindu Youth UK, which focuses upon get-connected extravaganzas, mobile festivals that are held across the country over the summer period. They feature a number of zones, for example, health, spirituality, children's, which attempt to bring together Hindus, young Hindus, and their many talents and professions. So far, the most successful zone has been the children's zone. And since one of the key findings of the Hindu Youth Report was that 90% of respondents agreed that it would be important to teach their children about Hinduism, this makes sense, that a key priority is for Hindus to be able to translate their faith so they can pass it on to the next generation. This also feeds a new market of communication. For example, the popularity of The Warrior Prince, The Legend of Prince Ram, a new video which is based on Valmiki's Ramayana, and it uses different forms of animation from Japan, USA and India. I started from the premise that there are no formal codes that define the core of Hinduism. Yet the nature of contemporary Hinduism shows a renewed interest in creating one. This is a mission that is engaging with new technologies and mediums and bringing forward certain texts and versions of stories that are felt to be of greater value in a British Western framework. There is also an attempt to redefine the limitations of this and further research and market the benefits that traditional practices like yoga or Ayurveda can bring. A problem that appears to be arising in this area is a lack of existing resources and educators. Hence, there has been a reliance upon sampradayas and the knowledge of religious texts and beliefs. As we begin to rapidly create a more universally accessible library, we need to be responsible for the knowledge production and aware of those who have accessibility to this. The contextual parameters, the historical background, political affiliation of the educators should be made accountable. And Bhattacharya warns of neo-colonial projects. The Occidental gaze is a funny thing. Even when we are taught to distrust its will to mastery, to unlearn the logics which take place, that look at the hidden origin of all stories, or all stories worth telling or hearing, it's hard to refuse. Shut your eyes and you're still in it, despite yourself. Somehow the control freak of the Western subject still creeps back in. Our will to knowledge reveals our own longing to partake in the power of the dominant. And that basically feeds into the wider politicization of Hinduism. The play also introduces a more political aspect. Brown introduces, this time the challenge is to progressive Gujarati Hindus who are prone today to fears of pollution and cultural arrogance, as are so many Muslims, Christians and Jews. In some British Hindu temples, India is being reclaimed from outsiders, including the people who gave India the Taj Mahal, and excuses are made for the murder of over 5,000 Muslims in Gujarat. apart from this introduction in the play, there is no mention of these wider political trends or issues in the rest of Strictly Dandia. And it's easy to miss the background politicisation of Hindus and Hinduism. And Brown makes this a little clearer as she adds, participative dance spaces, right from Romeo and Juliet, are theatres of personal passion where the forces of conservatism, form, pattern, rules, expectations can be subverted and reconfigured. And this she refers to the background of the play in the Navratri dance performance. And this Navratri event becomes a playground where the politics of contemporary faith issues and identities are played out. Stuart Hall's work on identity politics has created a space to talk about the personal as political, basically how politics is shaped by the ordinary experiences of men and women, which feminists, race and cultural theorists have embraced as an opportunity to participate in politics from the periphery. As the context shifts from immigration to second generations living in multicultural Britain, these older debates have needed a revisiting. The power relations are no longer white majority ethnic minority, and it would be politically naive to ignore intra and inter-ethnic relations and the growth of minority nationalism. Strictly Dandia shows the fragility of inter-caste relations between Shahs, Patels and Luanas, with the micro-power struggles for the organisation of the annual event. And it is clear that Hindu Punjabis are present by formal invitation only to this local community event. Yet a unity between these different castes and regional Hindu backgrounds is articulated at a moment when Muslims enter the relationship. And this is a conversation between two of the characters. Thought I recognised a bit of Bhangra there, a bit of change in the light bulbs. Well, Brahma, this is proof in the pudding, the success of your open door policy. This is about the entrance of Hindu Punjabis into this Gujarati event. Well, anyone is welcome as long as they respect their intention. Yes, the only difference between us and Punjabis is that they eat barantas and we eat dalbat, and it's showing in our bodies. Bushba, the trouble starts when Muslims come into it, isn't it? Well, we've never had any incidents at our functions. Well, they can't look at their girls, so they come to look at ours. And one of these days it's going to happen the other way around, and then what will happen? There were many discussions amongst the students about the threat that Muslim men pose to Hindu women and a primary reason why Hindus should mobilise in contemporary times. Hindu and Sikh women were seen as particularly vulnerable and as possible victims, as Muslims were seen as organising conversion campaigns on student campuses. And this starts to illustrate the creation of surveillance of religious boundaries amongst young people in a way that claims ownership over young Hindus in general and young women in particular. A major discourse that has emerged from this is that Hindus can no longer take their faith or identity for granted and need to be active rather than reactive. Raj describes this pro-Hindu in her analysis of the National Hindu Students Forum. However, she writes at a time when the Hindu Youth UK, which is a non-politically aligned organisation, does not exist. What both NHSF and Hindu Youth UK hope to provide is a forum that encourages cooperation and interaction between Hindu youth. And this means creating unity across gender, caste and regional differences and asserting a pan-Hindu identity. As one young spokesperson adds, we want to promote Hindu nationalism, wherein Hindu Punjabis, South Indians, followers of ISKCON, Swaminarayan or Brahma Kumaris come together under the same banner and work together. There are many other reasons why this desire for unity has become more urgent. The Hindu Youth Report highlights the fear that many young Hindus have of their identity dying out as the next generation lack the ability to maintain temples, religious institutions and caste structures. Significantly, it is the inability to pass on religious instruction to a future generation that is of major concern. Students also felt that being part of an umbrella Hindu youth organisation would allow them to be heard and have a stronger recognition within the political system. And one student claimed, faith has to be reinvented, otherwise no one recognises anyone else's community or identity. The student went on to suggest that faiths such as Sikhism and Islam had a much stronger religious and political recognition in the media and mainstream political institutions, which resulted from the from organised bodies and political lobbying. Another issue that Hindus raised for the need for unity was from trying to find prospective partners for marriage, which is becoming harder within their confined caste structures. The sentiments that drive these pro-Hindu activities, a sense of threat and need for active response, is unfortunately being met by Hindu nationalist organisations which are emerging in the diaspora. The emergence of the Hindu right in the UK is well documented by an edition of Race and Ethnic Studies called Hindutva in the West, which is dedicated to this issue. They find evidence for the emergence of the Sangh in Britain. The origins lie with the Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh, RSS, Association of National Volunteers, formed in 1923 in India, which has developed into a larger Sangh Parivar along an RSS, Vishwa Hindu Parishad, and BJP axis. They support the formation of a Hindu Rashtra on the basis of Sangh ideals, which are shaped by Savarkar and Golwalkar. They basically claim that Hinduism and Hindu-ness are defined by ethnic, territorial and blood ties rather than religious practices or beliefs. In Savarkar's words, a Hindu is one who sees the Bharatvarsha as his fatherland, holy land and cradle of his religion. This Hindu-ness, this essence, they call Hindutva, which is thus a matter of culture rather than religious commitment, and an ethnic marker of peoplehood. And this ideology serves provocatively to alienate India's Christian and religious minorities. The contributors to this edition of Hindutva in the West describe the interpretations of Hindu identity as an all-encompassing one to which other identities of class, caste, gender are subordinate, and the bearers of that identity share a distinct culture, despite variation. The Hindu Swayamsevak Sangh, which is an offshoot of the RSS, established in London in 1966 by the first RSS worker, and the VHP have also been seen to be heading or taking a lead role in formulating a Hindu point of view on medical, health and educational issues in Britain. The main achievements in this country have been events like the Hindu Marathon in Bradford, a Hindu Sammelan in Milton Keynes, and the publishing of a major religious studies text by the VHP called Explaining Hindu Dharma. They have been successful predominantly because militancy is downplayed and they emphasise Hindu hurt and Hindu denigration and a shared cultural heritage. My research upon student society activities found strong indirect links with HSS bodies that serve to politicise young Hindus in the name of Hindutva projects. The National Hindu Student Forum, like other national religious student religious organisations, see themselves as preparing a future generation of leaders who will be suitably equipped to participate in British life, whether as community leaders or religious professionals. But explicitly notes how... NHSF is precisely aimed at recruiting and retaining those at further education, colleges and universities, and bringing them closer to the Sangh. The NHSF project has been fairly successful, and a generation of youth are being exposed to Hindutva ideology in an organised and systematic form for the first time ever in the UK. And there are strong indications that the National Hindu Student Forum, the members have been drawn from local RSS cells, which are called, and activities based around the Shaka, which share the same structure as the RSS in India. They share similar slogans and, for example, initiation is attending camps. And they also share speakers, for example, David Frawley, a journalist called Francois Gauthier, and many others. There are also links with another body called Seva International, which is a charity body, and which has been implicated in collecting funds for RSS activities in India. And just today, a report's been launched, which is called In Bad Faith. And this is organised by a body called Awaz, which tries to look at the activities of these bodies in the light of the incidents which took place in Gujarat in 2002. And the report's called In Bad Faith, British Charity and Hindu Extremism. They basically are trying to remove the charitable status of bodies like Seva International and the HSS in India, as they found that money that was collected in their name has been used to fund RSS projects in India. And Hindu students in this country have been collecting these funds across university campuses. So they are trying to urge public donors to refuse to give funds for them. So in conclusion, I've spoken about four very different areas: business, cultural performances, religious beliefs and politics. However, in the context of contemporary Hindus and Hinduism, they are very related. I began with cultural consumerism and the idea that Hindus, notably second generation, are trying to rebrand Hinduism and their faith identity. And this is by using their unique socioeconomic position in this country and their affluent and they're trying to create a pan-Hindu national identity that represents a successful minority group that has integrated into this country. And their faith is based across ethnic, cultural, and faith boundaries. Unfortunately, there is also a responsibility for scholars, community representatives, and Hindu organizations to ensure that we allow space for minority practices within Hinduism to have an accessibility into this new rebranding of Hinduism, and also avoid the politicization of this by groups such as the HSS in this country, which are using this new rebranding to bring across their own agendas based on this very narrow definition of what Hindu and Hinduism is, which I would define as Hindu imperialism. That's it. Thank you.
Question is about the word British. Where does the word, how
themselves as British Hindus?
Okay. Well, I think that arises through their class position. As they, as I said, they describe themselves Hindu also to mark their closer parity with the middle class in this country. Mm-hmm. And for them, that is what makes them British. And also in terms of religious identity, because the first generation were so intent on making an economic life for themselves, they were able to assimilate more easily. And so the second generation have quite naturally built upon that. And I think the Britishness is actually, they're more comfortable with than their Hindu identity, I personally feel. I feel that aspect of their is what they're trying to recreate. And the Britishness is actually something they do take for granted.
Maybe to one of the pieces you had up on the showing up there mentioned that trying to get everyone together, including South Indians and ISKCON and so on. And I'm wondering if you have any impressions about South Indian, North Indian differences in accommodation to British society. Because in India, I spend my time in the South mainly, and it seems culturally and religiously different, with a different sense of identity, Dravidian culture and so on, as opposed to Gujarati or Bengali. Do you notice here in the UK much difference between how South Indians are handling things as opposed to North Indians?
I feel they're virtually excluded from the trends that I've described. Even in the university environment, South Indian students were not really interested even in joining the Hindu society. And I feel that their religious practice is a lot more private and a lot less organised within this public manner. And so I feel they're quite invisible, and there hasn't been any academic or very much academic or scholarly work upon them whatsoever. So I feel that's an area actually that needs to be developed more.
Do you think it's because they come from more conservative, orthodox backgrounds in the South, and those are harder to adjust to a pluralistic Hindu culture in the UK? Or is it just they don't feel they fit in with other Indians? I know, I'm just thinking of an example. I had recently a conversation with a professor in Madras who explained the reason he and his family couldn't come to the UK to visit was because they always drink their water from the family well. And there would be no way to drink water if they came to the UK. And it struck me as making perfect sense in terms of him and where he was living in Chennai and so on. I'm wondering if there's that sense of like Sri Vaishnavism or Shaiva Siddhanta in the South are very orthodox, and therefore it has to be private because you can't mix it in with what other people are up to.
Fortunately, I don't have enough information to comment on that. And I also know that they are tradition. And that's what I feel minority religious communities are also taking part in. So that's the key aim, is to highlight elements of their religious identity that can be celebrated. And quite superficial aspects. So it's no longer about what religious practice would mean to individuals. It's about creating this more marketable religious identity which can be represented to non-Hindus. And I agree, it's a cross-community thing. And it's also trying to, that's why I think there is this wider politicization of Hinduism, because they're trying to link up these minority traditions with the wider international movements to have a stronger identity, not just within this country, but in USA, India.
You mentioned how a lot of Hindu people are trying to redefine what Hinduism is, remodel it, rebrand it, or whatever. And you mentioned how nationalism is one means of doing that, as well as economic status, culture, language, and so on. Would you say that actually nationalism is perhaps the most popular at the moment amongst young people? And my second question would be, are there actually moves to counter such a nationalistic perspective on Hinduism?
Well, I think I have tried to distinguish between what I describe as pro-Hindu and pro-Hindutva, which are both nationalisms, but very different types of nationalism. The first, I think, actually, I can understand the motivation for this, which are trying to live with the difference and trying to perpetuate a religious identity in this country. And so, for example, the need to come together for Hindu young Hindus is to try and re-educate themselves about their faith, and also, as I said, to teach their children next generation. The second form of nationalism, which is Hindu nationalism, is something I do have a problem with. But unfortunately, I feel it's disguised, and it's very much incorporated into this pro-Hindu movement. And the ideology, the historical background is very invisible. And that is what this report, which I said was launched today, is trying to counter. But it's a very, very small, I think it's a very small counter movement to do this. And actually that is a major concern, I think, of future work, is trying to identify the difference between the two types of nationalism. Because young Hindus themselves are learning about Hindutva as Hinduism. That is a major area of future work.
You referred once or twice to the sort of activity of the Arya Samaj. Say a bit more about that, because sort of I associate that with its 19th century origins, but it sounds from what you say as though it's still quite active in shaping identity and community as well.
I think it's quite interesting, because I found a lot of youth from university very attracted to the Arya Samaj. Again, because of its very neo-Hindu beliefs. And they felt that that was more rational, made sense to them. For example, their beliefs that they that against idol worship was something that they could explain to other people. And the Arya Samaj also trying to maintain the Vedas is the most central aspect of Hinduism. So again, it's any kind of Hindu organization which has a stronger structure and framework of beliefs is one that the second generation are attracted to. So I think that Arya Samaj is also growing in prominence in this country.
Can you just say who is behind this report that you mentioned?
The name is Awaz, AWAAZ, and they call themselves South Asia Watch. And it's an organization which grew after the 2002 Gurdwara incident. Is everyone familiar with that? Basically, in February 2002, a train returning from Ayodhya, there was about 52, I think, Hindus that were burnt alive at a station called Gurdwara. And this basically, the mob that set alight this train, apparently was a group of Muslims who were incensed by, there's lots of different interpretations, but they were incensed by the pilgrimage from Ayodhya, because they're trying to build a mandir there, and they've destroyed a anyway, this is basically triggered off huge communal riots in Gujarat, which left 2,000 Muslims dead and displaced lots and lots of other Muslim minorities. And the main claim is that this was organised communal violence, which was state-sponsored. And it doesn't seem to have received international coverage. And a major campaign which is being organised by this group has been how money collected in this country under the pretext of Seva charity was used to fund this violence without public knowledge. So these links haven't been made clear. And they have compiled this report to try and take away the charity status of these bodies, of these right-wing bodies in this country. That's the background of the report.
This thing about Muslims coming to look at our girls, have you found that both young men and young women are equally anxious about that?
No. It was definitely a masculine.
Yes, that's what I was saying.
It was. It's amazing how much. It's actually a very, very an issue that was highlighted again and again and again. Students held conferences, and this was always an issue that was brought up by the Hindu men. They always wanted it on their agenda.
You know, we should look at our girls.
You know, the threat that as I said, organised campaigns for conversion were taking place. And Hindu women who had no brains were very vulnerable and had a weak religious identity would fall prey to these predators. Again, some research on that to provide some factual evidence would be quite good as well.
Well, I guess we should draw things to conclusion, and I guess some of these very practical issues about living together in diverse communities have been one of the things we've been trying to address in talking about relating to the other in across all sorts of different ways. And I think you've given us some very clear insights into some of the issues that face us as contemporary communities in this country and indeed touching across the globe as well. So thank you very much for sharing your work with us, and we hope that you'll be back around in Oxford shortly. Thank you very much.